crash, mash, mash, blast the system. We wanna get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, fist pumping, rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want, we want, we want, we want. We want a liberated land supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own my special interest groups that fund their campaign.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we discuss the importance of alternative independent media in the face of growing concerns that big tech platforms are increasingly censoring these voices. We'll be joined by independent journalist David Pakman. We'll also hear from Professor Andrew Austin, and a familiar voice will join us as a guest, Dr. Nolan Higdon. Stay with us.
Crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies like an ominous.
And welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Chase Palmieri. On today's show, we'll discuss the importance of alternative and independent media in the face of growing concerns that big tech platforms are increasingly censoring these very important voices. Later in the program, we'll hear from Professors Nolan Higdon and Andrew Austin. We'll be talking about the Alex Jones issue as well as internet censorship. But in the first segment, we're going to be joined by a very important voice in the alternative media. And here is Chase Palmieri to introduce our first guest to you today. Chase?
Our first guest today is David Pakman. David Pakman is the host and executive producer of The David Pakman Show, which started as a community radio program in 2005. The show has since grown a lot and is now distributed to over 180 affiliate TV and radio stations across five countries, including distribution on DirecTV and Dish Network, and a YouTube channel, which is actually where I first came across him, that has hundreds of millions of views and just under 500,000 subscribers. David, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you speak to what it's like to not have a boss and how that makes your content different than what we see on cable news? And do you think of YouTube as your boss now that they have begun censoring certain voices?
For me, it's more that I think of the audience as the boss. I mean, one of the great freedoms of doing what I do at this point is that no one person has enough power or leverage over what I do that they can influence the content in any significant way. So really every audience member is kind of my boss, and YouTube certainly has more power maybe than like an individual affiliate station just because of the sheer reach and importance of that. But really, the great thing is that I will often do stories that I know are going to trigger not the greatest reaction from my audience. My audience is not on board with every one of my views, but that's okay because there's no editor and there's no one person that can say, you know what, we don't like what you're doing and we're going to pull you off the air or reduce your time or whatever the case may be. So I really think of my audience as the boss.
David Pakman, Mickey Huff here, certainly very familiar with your program, was on it once upon a time back when we were in Denver at one of the media reform conferences. You and Chase were just talking about YouTube as a platform and not having a boss that the listeners are, but yet you've described yourself as an actual independent voice in terms of your journalism. Would you say that? Would you say that you think you're a completely independent voice in terms of alternative media?
Well, it depends what you mean by independent. I mean, there's certainly no overarching corporate structure, editor, boss, anyone who can create an ultimatum that would influence my content, right? And I think that independence can mean different things. Is it financial independence? Is it editorial independence? I think that, without a question, this setup has gotten me the closest to that that I've ever seen or can imagine. And there's no question that anytime we have an advertiser or we have even the audience contributing financially, one could argue that does, in a way, create a financial incentive for us to act in a way where we don't lose that funding, right? So you can always find that financial incentive that might influence people. But as I mentioned, there's no one source of funding that's so important that it would really dictate the coverage we do, the story choice that I do, which is completely my decision, what we cover. In that sense, we are independent.
So, David, later in the show, we're going to be discussing the recent news around the Alex Jones situation and how he has been removed from some of the major tech platforms. Just to name some of those platforms, Jones was banned in some form or another by Apple, Facebook, YouTube, Spotify, MailChimp, Discus, and LinkedIn. These are obviously private companies, so the First Amendment doesn't necessarily apply to them. It's more to do with how Alex Jones' content broke their community guidelines in terms of service. But should free speech principles apply to these platforms, which have in a way become our digital public squares?
A couple different thoughts and approaches on that. First, there's the legal question, which you've already addressed, which is that legally speaking, there doesn't seem to be any issue here. There is one caveat to that, which is that there is a relatively obscure case, which I can only paraphrase, from the 60s, which argues that once a private company has large enough market share, they have the responsibility of a government entity. Whether or not these platforms have achieved that status can be debated. But I think that the more important question is the one that you're bringing up, which is one of how organizations behave. And I'm pretty close to a free speech absolutist, where my view is that unless something is against the law, I would like to see it allowed on platforms. Now, that being said, I completely respect that these platforms have a desire to police the content that appears. And when you start getting into sort of that gray area where, well, if you do conspiracy theories that point to particular individuals as alleged perpetrators of who knows what it was that Alex Jones was alleging about Comet Ping Pong, does that directly lead to harassment, which of course is against the guidelines that have been established by these platforms? So my preference would be that these horrible ideas that people like Alex Jones present merely not get any attention and have no one pay attention to them. That's certainly not the case, and I believe that every single one of those platforms individually acted in a way that makes sense. What I have a little bit of a problem with is the idea that the content from Alex Jones has been pretty similar for years. Nothing actually changed over the last 2 weeks that would make it so that every single one of these platforms would, within days of each other, make the decision to pull the content off. So what I don't like about it is this sort of PR calculation that clearly went into it, and they all acted together.
Ironically, David Pakman, is that then not the definition of some kind of commercial conspiracy between the big tech platforms to all basically drop Jones at the same time?
Well, if you're going to allege a conspiracy, that would imply that they were coordinating with each other. I have no evidence to suggest that that's the case. I think it's quite possible and even most likely that as soon as one platform said we're going to pull a few episodes, another platform said let's also pull a few episodes, and that led to a third platform to say, what's the environment's right to pull the entire thing? So I don't know of any evidence of coordination, which is what conspiracy is. I think that because it's so public, the actions that these companies take are so public, you don't really need to conspire or coordinate.
I think part of the problem is that Alex Jones was almost deplatformed entirely, as opposed to it being his individual one piece of content, maybe that one video that took it too far being removed.
Where he was threatening.
Well, yeah, whether or not it was a threat or gestures, I think, is a little bit up for debate. But, David, I'd like to see if I can get you to speculate a little bit further on this. Recently, Facebook and other tech platforms have been facing Congress, and Congress has been talking about regulating these platforms as public utilities. Do you think that there's any chance that this behavior, the deplatforming of Alex Jones, was in some way to appease Congress, to show them that they are taking action, that they don't need to be regulated?
I think that there's no question that the platforms know it's not in their best interest to have more regulation, as is often the case in most industries that are sort of oligopolies in a sense, where you have few players controlling a huge market share, it's rarely in their interest to have more regulation. So at the 30,000-foot level, of course Facebook and YouTube are going to act in a way that they think will get attention, regulatory attention, away from them. Is the Alex Jones move in and of itself enough to really do that? I kind of have a hard time believing that. It's very difficult for me to imagine that in the face of structural regulation platform-wide or social media-wide, that showing up and saying, hey, but we banned Alex Jones, is going to appease regulators and legislators. It's just hard for me to imagine that.
On the program today, we're talking about the importance of alternative and independent media in the face of big tech platforms and the issues of removing content. We're speaking now with David Pakman of The David Pakman Show, longtime on Free Speech TV and, of course, on many other places online, including YouTube. And before the break, we were getting into the recent controversy, recent among many, involving people like Alex Jones and InfoWars. And we were getting into the idea of how these companies are really rising to such a size and such a level in terms of market share and media and social media that when does this amount to a form of censorship? And I wanted to bring up this point. We'd have to define things like conspiracy and so forth. And we're not here talking about the content of Jones per se, and we're not defending the content of Jones. We're specifically talking about the rights of people to have platforms or the rights of people to have a voice, and what role do these big tech platforms play when they take that away from certain people and then it is actually based on content. So going back a couple weeks, David Pakman, Matt Taibbi recently wrote about this in Rolling Stone. We saw a campaign against, quote, inauthentic content conducted by Facebook and also a think tank, the Atlantic Council, whose board includes an array of ex-CIA and Homeland Security officials, Taibbi writes, under the guise of Russian disinformation efforts and all that is Russiagate, we're seeing increased pressure behind the scenes that these kinds of people are actually consulting with tech companies and suggesting perhaps what kind of content they may or may not want to see or hear. David Pakman, your view on that?
I'd love to hear a little bit more about which part you want me to comment on. I mean, it's, you know, the thinly veiled reference to skepticism about Russiagate, I think, is a very separate issue from that of how social media platforms should regulate and police content that exists there. If the question is more about who gets to decide what content is authentic or inauthentic, that's an ongoing issue that I have unfortunately not yet really seen a good solution to. Certainly when Donald Trump suggested that the government would decide who's fake news and who's real news, every one of us should be extraordinarily scared about that. Who gets to decide? Does Facebook get to police their own platform, and where are the limits of that? I've not really seen good objective delineation.
One thing that I've heard that sounds like a somewhat fair compromise is that these tech platforms can ban content, but that they would have to do it in a transparent way where there's some kind of an online publicly visible trial with evidence that is pointed to say this is why this person was banned. That might be a fair compromise. Do you think that something like that might be the solution in the near term?
I don't see how you actually, number one, put that together in a way that everybody would feel as though it's fair. And number two, I don't know from a legal perspective how you enforce that. And if you say, well, when you've gotten to a certain size as an online platform, you have to have this sort of panel or adjudication procedure, I guess, that you're kind of suggesting, fair enough. But how do you decide what big enough means? Is it based on number of unique users, number of visits, amount of content shared? I think that these ideas all come from a good place, which is that there's a major problem with disinformation online, and yet we also want to create a situation where we don't feel as though speech is being arbitrarily censored. I genuinely don't know.
Right, and another issue is whether or not you treat different voices in different ways based on the number of followers that they have. So, for example, would that Alex Jones video that has caused this situation have been taken down if it was somebody who had posted that video on YouTube and only had 10 followers? For example, do you weigh it more heavily because of the impact it might actually have out in the real world? And is that fair? But one question I want to ask you, David, is during the YouTube apocalypse, as they call it, did that affect your channel in any way?
As I've done a number of videos about, we in the immediate aftermath of that apocalypse lost 99% of our YouTube revenue. So we were significantly affected. Now, that's since been resolved, and a majority of that ad revenue has returned, but we were extraordinarily impacted by it. Now, in terms of content being censored, no. We did have videos on so-called sensitive topics demonetized or enter a limited monetization state, but that wasn't something new.
Okay, and obviously your channel and all of your audience has grown a lot since 2005 when you first started. I'm wondering where you think you'll be another 5 years from now. Where does the David Pakman Show go next? Does it just continue growing subscribers on YouTube? Does it join up with a bigger platform? Where do you see yourself maybe 5 years from now?
Right now, we have no particular plans or desire to join up with bigger platforms. One thing I have learned over the last 10 years is that it's extraordinarily difficult to predict what opportunities will come up even in the next 2 years. So I basically have stopped making any sort of predictions about where we will be in 5 years. Technology will have evolved significantly. I'll be 5 years older, and who knows what my interests will be at the time relative to what they are now politically.
So, David Pakman, since we've been referring to your show, could you tell our listeners where to find your work? We'd certainly be remiss if we didn't say that. Could you give out some websites and give some information where listeners can find your work if they're not already familiar?
Yeah, the central place is our website, davidpakman.com, where we have both audio and visual content. And of course, we exist on over 150 radio and television stations. We're on YouTube. The podcast is on iTunes and Stitcher. iHeartRadio recently was added to Spotify. And we're also the nightly Monday through Friday program on Free Speech TV. The same show on all those platforms. You're not getting different stuff. So whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on the radio, it's the same daily show. So any of those platforms are great places to check out either by listening or watching.
So davidpakman.com, P-A-K-M-A-N. And you can also learn, of course, you can learn everything about David Pakman there. And you can also follow that on Free Speech TV. David Pakman, thanks so much for taking time to share your thoughts about these important issues, and we certainly wish you all the best moving forward. It seems that we're getting into stranger and stickier times with technology and algorithms and so on, and we need independent and alternative media voices now maybe more than ever.
Thank you.
And you're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. In that segment, we were speaking with David Pakman of The David Pakman Show. And we're going to continue our conversation about issues surrounding independent media, alternative media, and the role big technology plays in platforms and how this really portends toward free speech and then free press questions. After this brief musical break, we'll be joined by Professor Andrew Austin and then later Nolan Higdon. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Chase Palmieri. In this segment of the program, we're going to continue our conversation about the importance of alternative independent media in the face of growing concerns that big tech companies are increasingly censoring independent and alternative voices on the basis of content. So we're joined right now by Dr. Andrew Austin. He's on the faculty of Democracy and Justice Studies at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. His areas of interest are crime and justice, political economy, and political sociology. His work has appeared in, among other places, the Journal of Poverty, Crime, Law and Social Change, Journal of Black Studies, Labor History, Journal of World Systems Research, and Capitalism, Nature, Socialism. Andrew Austin, we welcome you back to the Project Censored Show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me back.
It's a pleasure, and one of the reasons that we are having you back on today is that, of course, I follow your writings and your musings on social media and on Facebook, and you certainly always been an interesting voice regarding free speech, free press issues, and I thought this would be a fantastic time to have you back, given the current climate, given that we're seeing not just big tech companies through algorithms basically filter out certain kinds of searches and certain kinds of content, but under the guise of so-called fake news and the rise of the so-called fake news phenomenon, we've seen push, not just from the public, but from government and from the big tech sector to do something, quote unquote, about fake news. And one of the things that's happening here is that we're starting to see these big tech companies make decisions about who gets a platform or who gets a voice, whether it's YouTube, Apple, Google, Facebook, Twitter, etc. And again, I know you've weighed in on this a lot online. One of the big issues that's been happening the past couple of weeks is Alex Jones of InfoWars, nearly simultaneously sacked from many of these platforms. And we just wanted to have you launch in at that point in terms of the issue of free press, and do you consider this a kind of censorship?
The background on this is that you're right, it was almost a simultaneous purging. You had Facebook, YouTube, Apple, Spotify, all coming out in a matter of several hours, removing Alex Jones, and in some cases his program InfoWars, from those social media sites. Specifically, Facebook, just to give you a quote for the reason why they did this, they said that Jones was, quote, glorifying violence, which violates our graphic violence policy, and using dehumanizing language to describe people who are transgender, Muslim, and immigrants, which violates our hate speech policy. And then, of course, the media, in giving examples to that, is very quick to bring up his famous role in 9/11, you know, arguing that there were false flag operations in the attacks that we suffered on 9/11. And probably most notorious of all is his argument that Sandy Hook incidents was a hoax replete with crisis actors. What strikes me about particularly the issue of censorship is the way in which this growth in what the Supreme Court has described as a modern public square is operating beyond the bounds of really the First Amendment. And so the question is, what role does free speech have in an increasingly privatized world in which you have monopolies, which are effectively utilities, deciding the content that then audiences can access? Because I think one of the most important things about free speech, people understand, is it's not just the speaker, it's the ability of people to be able to hear opinion. So this has very deep possibilities, if you will, in a negative sense, I think, for freedom going forward.
There is an idea out here that because this is the private sector, although it's interesting to unpack that given how many corporate tax subsidies and how much research and development and how much of that bleeds into companies like Google, particularly from the military-industrial complex. So there's mm-hmm. clearly a blurring, I would argue, there. But nevertheless, one of the arguments, and I'd like to hear your views on this, one of the arguments about this issue is that these are private companies. And so, therefore, if someone is on that platform and they are behaving in a way that does not behoove the shareholders or does not behoove the company's interests in its public image, that it has the right to not have people. And so this gets to be complicated in terms of the way that it contradicts the spirit of the First Amendment. However, it's also perfectly legal until challenged.
The analogy in my mind for all this is public accommodations. And the segregationists argued that equal treatment provision of the 14th Amendment, that the language strongly suggested that only the government cannot discriminate, right? So that a private company can discriminate. So the segregationists would say, well, I can decide, I own the restaurant, I can decide who can be in the restaurant or not, who I can associate with, and so forth. And the Civil Rights Act of 1964 clarified that, right, that the right to not be discriminated against
was at the individual level. It had to do with individual sovereignty, not with the right of property to exclude people. And that the protection of the First Amendment wasn't just about the government sort of not oppressing people, but the government defending the oppression of people by private entities. And when you think of these monopolies as really being functionally public utilities, I really believe there's a public accommodations issue. And just as we promote racial diversity in public spaces that are operated by private firms, that we also need to recognize ideological and intellectual diversity in these spaces as well. I would think that the First Amendment would cover that. Maybe it will take another act of Congress to clarify that situation. I mean, they're having to clarify the situation with respect to, say, the free speech rights of gay couples to have their sentiments expressed on cakes in private businesses. We'll see how that works out. But I see that as very analogous. I also see it as really running up against the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the European Declaration of Human Rights, Articles 19 in the former and 10 in the latter, right, of protecting the right of individuals to be able to transmit information unimpeded and in a private world. That shouldn't make any difference that these firms are private if that's indeed a human right. The idea that a private sphere could interfere with the human rights of individuals is difficult for me to accept.
So, Andrew, obviously Alex Jones is the canary in the coal mine for this issue right now. Have you seen that there are also some other independent voices on the left that are starting to be censored in the same way?
If we're paying attention, we'll see that there's been several canaries here. Before Alex Jones and this rather highly publicized deplatforming, Facebook, going back, contrary to what Zuckerberg said, you might remember when he bragged about how Facebook would not censor Holocaust deniers and revisionists from having the debate. But the fact is that going back to 2005, Facebook has been deplatforming those who question the Holocaust. They deactivated Corinne Gaines' account, which meant that they removed Philando Castile's killing at the hands of police. It was something that, at the time, we were making note of, but has been quickly forgotten. They removed that iconic photograph, the Napalm Girl, you know, Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer Nick Ut. They censored that. They've removed the reports of the suppression of indigenous resistance. They've removed not merely black activist content, but they've removed reports of black activist content, sort of depriving people of the right to complain about Facebook's removal of content. And then we've seen the dismantling, or I should say the disabling, of Palestinian journalist accounts. In fact, after Zuckerberg met with Israeli Prime Minister, there was a string of removals of Palestinian sites, and Telesur, it was just taken down. This is a site that Breitbart describes as communist propaganda. So you can see a real ideological bias in the sites that are being taken down. And yes, what I tell people about the Alex Jones affair is that they've coming after the left, and we're not just arguing a slippery slope here. They have been coming after the left for quite a long time, which is not to suggest that Holocaust denial is something on the left. They're also doing this with some Christian ministries that have particularly vile content about homosexuals and so forth. But the effects on the left, which many, we have to admit that many people on the left saw Alex Jones being taken down with relish. They enjoyed that. They need to, I think, be a bit concerned about what that legitimizes.
I was pleasantly surprised to see Steve Paul from Columbia in the Washington Post and in Bezos' paper, which has obviously got problems of its own in terms of censorship and how the Bezos Washington Post doesn't allow its employees to criticize advertisers on social media. But to see Steve Paul there and arguing essentially the point of like, hey, you know, this is something we need to be careful about. Glenn Greenwald, of course, last year was writing about how Facebook admitted publicly it was deleting accounts at the direction of U.S. and Israeli governments.
That's right.
To name just a couple. You're right. The World Socialist website was writing about this a year ago, and we were covering it in Censored Books, about the significant downtick of traffic and the spiking of Google searches. And even our own site, projectcensored.org, experienced significant decline during this period of what appears to be a kind of search engine or algorithmic kind of suppression. So it's happening in a lot of different ways.
I'd like to remind our audience that we're the Project Censored Show with Mickey Huff and Chase Palmieri, and we'll be right back after this musical break. Stay with us.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Chase Palmieri. I wanted to focus on the one thing that you just said a moment ago, Andrew Austin, and that's that in the case of Alex Jones, where we have someone that's very contentious, right? And again, broken clocks were right twice a day. Alex has actually had some decent analysis factually on certain issues around civil rights and so forth, civil liberties over the years. But of course, that gets drowned out by the several examples that you gave up, particularly Sandy Hook and so on, and crisis actors and so forth. But there is a sense of some celebration among other free speech characters. In fact, KPFA, the station where we originate from, has recently canceled a controversial program, Guns and Butter, by Bonnie Faulkner, that actually carried many of these kinds of arguments and talked about these kinds of things. And so under the auspice of Free Speech Radio, we see, well, hey, they say, well, we can't seem to afford to have that kind of programming and that kind of what they call false news. Or see, we're getting into this fake news issue, news is a Trojan horse to somehow censor certain viewpoints. What's your idea on that?
I'm troubled by that because, I mean, it's long been the case that the Supreme Court has recognized a certain freedom, if you will, to lie, a freedom to distort, a freedom to engage in parody and satire. And sometimes it's difficult to know what it is that you're looking at. I mean, Alex Jones, I'm a bit perplexed by him at times. You know, he described himself in a court transcript as being a performance artist. And for years, I've kind of thought of him as a performance artist. Like, can a person really believe this stuff? He was on the Joe Rogan show fairly recently, and they were drinking and getting high, and it was really comical. And he let Rogan and the audience in on a kind of a joke about who Alex Jones is. I think the problem is they have these algorithms that are targeting and selecting and so forth, but what a lot of people don't know is there's around 7,500 human censors at Facebook, and we don't know who they are. They're all over the planet. What is their expertise? Are they particularly keen on being able to distinguish between what's parody and what's this and so forth? And do we really want, even if they could do that, would we really want people deciding what it is we can and can't see? I've always been a bit suspicious of people who watch something and say, well, gosh, that's terrible. We shouldn't let people see that. And it's like, I'm sure you don't have a problem with seeing it, but you want other people not to see it. And the idea that we would let people make decisions for other people about what kind of media they consume, whether it's on the right or whether it's on the left or whether it's parody or whether it's distortion, so forth, it's very troubling to me. Again, it goes back to that argument we used to make in the 1980s. Remember when they were trying to put warning labels on music? We don't want people listening to Judas Priest's song, you know, Eat Me Alive.
The PMRC.
So it's a very clever song, I thought. And you know, but the thing is, nobody forces you to listen to Judas Priest. Nobody forces people to watch Alex Jones. And so we have this modern public square, as Kennedy described it, but it's an odd kind of public square. It's almost more like the television, where people can slot in and watch that. If they don't like that, they can step out and so forth. So the idea that people making choices to consume media is a great danger and therefore we have to control what people see says something about this monopoly's opinion of the ordinary person who's out there trying to get information or is trying to just enjoy something. I mean, one thing you can say about Alex Jones, it is a spectacle to behold on a comedic level. It's quite entertaining. And so I just don't trust, particularly I don't trust Zuckerberg to decide for me the content that I should consume.
Andrew, speaking of ordinary people, many in the general public were cheering on these decisions.
Mm-hmm.
What is the appropriate response for the general public? And then after that response, what do you think the general public should be doing right now in this current moment?
First of all, the public has a perfect right to organize and protest speech that they don't like. I mean, that's their free speech right, too. So if people want to say, I don't like what Alex Jones is saying. But I also think that these services have an obligation to defend speech against the majoritarian impulse. Free speech is a civil liberty. And we're talking about majoritarianism. We're not even talking about organized democratic intervention, right? We're talking about flack that's being sent by large numbers of people, interest groups that are presumed to be the majority. Twitter, you know, they didn't do this in the case of Roseanne Barr and some others, but they have done this with respect to Alex Jones. They have resisted not only the calls of what appear to be very large numbers of the public, but also other media, which is actually going through and saying, well, you say that he's not violating your terms, but yet you ban this person for this reason and this person for this reason. So we have the corporate media is really putting a lot of pressure on Twitter to try to follow suit. For the public, there's always going to be those who are going to respond to things that are offensive by organizing boycotts and campaigns and petitions and so forth and so on. But I think we have to make the argument that as despicable as speech can be, that the free speech right, and this is cliche, but it's so important to repeat, the free speech right is there precisely to protect despicable speech. I mean, if it was a matter of protecting speech that we agreed with, we wouldn't need a right. That's the easy part. And so the public needs to be educated about what the First Amendment means, but also be educated about the threat to the First Amendment when monopolies become the de facto government and inflate the concept of defamation, for instance, way beyond its foundation in, say, English common law. One of the famous reasons that Christopher Hitchens gave for leaving England is that it was becoming almost impossible to be critical over there because you were losing the right to complain because you would defame somebody and you would wind up in court having to fight for that right. So I think it's a matter of educating the public about the free speech right, connecting it to our fundamental human rights, and arguing for a vigorous defense of speech against the majority, against the government, and in particular in this case we're talking about, against these giant social media platforms, which have an absolutely unbelievable amount of power. I mean, Facebook is global and reaches one-third of the world's population, and they're teaming with the security state. We can talk about the Atlanta Council, sort of the core of the intelligence and security apparatus, the privatized core, we should say, privatized core of that. We have Facebook actually bringing them on board to become part of this human censorship machine. That's very, very troubling. Because you have, as you were pointing out earlier, at the behest of the U.S. and Israeli government, you have Zuckerberg taking down websites. And so even though they're saying, well, we're private and we should be free from government control, they're in bed with government. And, of course, they obviously depend on government fundamentally because the Internet, the very service that they depend on, was developed by the government, supported by the taxpayers, and functions quite analogously to the electric grids or to telecommunication.
That's exactly right, Andrew. You're right. We don't need the First Amendment to protect our right to say, I love cupcakes and pizza is good. That's not why we have the First Amendment. And you're also right that Twitter has responded differently than other tech platforms in the space in regards to censorship. In fact, one of the features that they introduced a while back was that they would blur out something that is apparently contentious in your newsfeed and then would allow you to click on it whether or not you actually want to see the content.
I don't have much of a problem with that because when you're scrolling through various pages or tweets and so forth, you can see things inadvertently that are very disturbing. And so it's a little bit different from selecting a channel and knowing what you're going to see. I think that's a reasonable compromise. It's nowhere close to just taking down a page because an internal censor believes that that would be offensive to a large number of people.
Andrew Austin, I misspoke earlier. I mentioned Steve Call from Columbia. His piece was actually in The New Yorker. The Washington Post piece that I was actually referring to was by David Green, who's from the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Yes.
Now that I'm correcting it, I wanted to get on to the piece that was in the Post about this issue in particular. EFF, of course, has a long record of protecting civil rights in cyberspace. For me and for Project Censored, this is one of the key elements. And the title is Alex Jones is Far From the Only Person Tech Companies Are Silencing. And Green goes through this argument and talks about content moderation. And in this article, he actually talks about how the EFF had something called the Santa Clara Principles. He's getting at the point of addressing that there are increasingly smaller numbers of companies that are controlling these platforms. And he goes on to talk about companies should publish the number of posts removed and accounts suspended, that they should give notice. Companies should provide notice and an explanation to each user whose content is removed and appeal. Companies should provide a meaningful opportunity for a timely appeal. This is what Green writes. So they're talking about accountability and transparency. What do you think about that kind of approach?
One of my big concerns was is that one of the nice things about government when government does something is that you have recourse, a redress of your grievances is the famous phrase, right? It took until this spring for Facebook to tell us what their community standards were. Turns out they had a 27-page censorship guide that they give to their human censors, who they call content moderators, who then decide that. But there's still no way of appealing when YouTube takes down pages, and when Facebook takes down pages, Spotify. In fact, Spotify has a really nasty message saying that anybody who does this will not get their page back. So so there's no way to negotiate. At some level, though, I think that's an attempt by these companies to try to stave off government regulation. When Zuckerberg was at his congressional hearings, when I was watching him, it looked very much like a person who was trying to answer questions very carefully to kind of keep the government at bay, that we don't want the government to step in and regulate. Now, a lot of those congressmen have different objections. If they had their way, they would probably censor, too, just different sorts of things. And there's a real burden on these companies to address the concerns of consumers because, you know, if I work for a private news organization, I'm getting paid for writing content, and there's an expectation that there'll be editorial control over that, right? They might publish my story or not. But here we're talking about people who are not the employees of Facebook, but who are consuming content that they provide in exchange for user data. I think another thing that we have to be very clear about is that Facebook is very transparent about what they do with our data. That's another reform that needs to be made, and you know, with Cambridge Analytica, and there's a lot of concern about that. So I'm not against reform, but I do see that the reforms are, I would say, around the margins, and I'm really concerned about the principle here. My ideal is that these services are just wide open. I think that's the best solution. And I think if people don't like what an Alex Jones says, then you have a system where you can set up a Facebook page. You know, you can find people to like your page and read your content, and you can provide withering critiques of Alex Jones.
Maybe have a social media of, by, and for the people, not of, by, and for big tech and the technocracy.
Well, I think it's a great way of putting it. It's a little frustrating that we haven't seen that. You know, I do grant that it's difficult to start up and build a company that has the reach of a Facebook. And I think that once it becomes established in our society, I think like so many other brands, people trust it and rely on it.
Well, Andrew Austin, you might want to check out tribeworthy.com. That's Chase Palmieri's way of handling some of that situation that you just described. I'd like to remind listeners, you're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Chase Palmieri. Andrew Austin is on the Faculty of Democracy and Justice Studies at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. And Andrew Austin, I'd like to thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us about these very important and ongoing issues today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was delightful.
Absolutely. We'll definitely have you back on because I think that this situation is going to continue and it may not be going in a direction that you or I would prefer. You're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. We were speaking with Professor Andrew Austin, and after this brief musical break, we'll continue our conversation about today's theme with Professor Nolan Higdon. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, in studio with Chase Palmieri. In this segment of the program, we're going to continue our conversation about the importance of alternative and independent media in the face of growing concerns that big tech platforms are increasingly censoring these very voices. Professor Nolan Higdon teaches communications and history in the San Francisco Bay Area. Of course, Project Censored Show listeners know Nolan because he's also co-host of the Project Censored Show. He is also on the board of Media Freedom Foundation and is a longtime contributor of numerous chapters to Project Censored Books going back several years. And Nolan and I, in fact, are embarking on yet another writing prospect on Trump and media and education, which brings us to the reason that we welcome Nolan Higdon to the Project Censored Show as a guest. Nolan, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Good to hear from you guys.
Well, Nolan Higdon, the reason that we have you on to talk about our topic today is recently a lot of these issues involving alternative independent media and big tech deplatforming certain people centers around Alex Jones and InfoWars. And about 5 years ago, you wrote a really important piece that we published at Project Censored called DisInfoWars. There is a war on for your mind, but maybe not the kind that Alex Jones was talking about. So what do you argue is the best way to maybe handle certain kinds of controversial views? Or how about this, to point a term, fake news? How do we deal with dis and misinformation? And again, I'm knowing that you're going to be culling from your experience as an educator.
Yeah, you know, it's weird. You bring up that piece from 5 years ago, DisInfoWars. When I wrote that at the time, I had mentioned a lot in the article about how the unsubstantiated claims that Jones was making were being adopted by the corporate media, and they were becoming part of our sort of mainstream political discourse. I never imagined at the time that a candidate would pick up those falsehoods, Donald Trump, and write him into the White House. I didn't see that happening in the future, unfortunately. It's a problem, without a doubt, that these falsehoods are being internalized as truths among the population, and then they're voting on these falsehoods. But right now, we're kind of in a weird situation where we don't have any solutions that are being implemented at a government level. I think everyone remembers the little dog and pony show where Mark Zuckerberg went in front of Congress, and he gave a talk about what Facebook was going to try and do, and then you saw these social media networks change their user agreements to make people feel more safe. But if you really step back, nothing has actually changed. These social media platforms still control their own destiny, and the government didn't regulate them. It just asked them to do the right thing. But they're not enforcing them to do the quote-unquote right thing. So it was kind of like an awkward moment that happened within the last couple of weeks, which is when Facebook and other social media platforms started refusing to carry InfoWars and Jones content. There was kind of like this liberal celebration. At the same time, liberals chided outlets like Twitter for not censoring Jones. And I think this is problematic on multiple levels. Number one, censorship has never been proven to really be a solution. It hasn't proven to be an effective solution. In fact, people usually find a way to get around censorship.
We hear what you're saying, Nolan, about censorship not being a solution. In fact, censorship often backfires. And in this case, whether it be Jones, and earlier in the program we talked about how it's not only Jones, it's from right to left, and in between, that there's unpopular views looking for a place to live. What I'm curious about then is a lot of this is coming up in the light of, well, what do we do about the problem of disinformation or misinformation? What do we do about the so-called scourge of fake news? So what would you say to that kind of challenge?
We really need a transformation of our education system. If you look back about 30 or 40 years ago, most nations in Europe and Asia and Northern Africa adopted some media literacy programming that they mandated. So young people going out into this hugely media-saturated world could have the skills and resources to kind of sift through media and be able to tell the difference between what is true and false and protect themselves. We didn't really do that here in the United States, and obviously this is really problematic for any sort of a democratic government. You need the people to be able to vote with as many facts as possible. So I think education is the solution, and it's not just something I believe. I mean, the data really bears this out. There's been a lot of studies recently that pointed out if you give people fake news and you tell them something's true over and over again, they're likely to believe it even after you tell them it's false. However, the more education people have in terms of critical thinking, that tends to be not the case. People who have critical thinking skills generally stand their ground, and they won't accept falsehood no matter how much you pressure them. So there really is a good argument to be made that education can solve the problem. Now, having said that, we're an instantaneous culture. It's going to take a long time. You know, you're really going to have to sort of get rid of a lot of the thinking processes the American public have now and change them to where they can stop and critically think about the content. And there's a lot of good educational resources out there. Obviously, Project Censored has a ton of them, and its sister project, the Global Critical Media Literacy Project, has some as well. But it's really about getting that stuff in the classroom as young as possible.
Nolan, is this an issue worldwide, or is it exaggerated here with the American media ecosystem?
This has largely become a worldwide problem, unfortunately. Well, first of all, with social media and fake news, you could see it in the Brexit vote. But this controlling of media structures and only allowing false information out, that's gone on for quite a long time. And you see Erdogan in Turkey, you know, North Korea, China has a billion-dollar infrastructure to do this. So a lot of these societies are saturated with fake news. What makes the United States, I think, really unique is that we have a very strong government influence on this fake news, largely through political parties, tied to a very strong corporate social media influence on fake news as well. Where a lot of these other countries, it tends to be the regime in power solely is in charge of the fake news.
Well, in terms of what's going on in the United States and corporate media, these big tech companies have a lock on a lot of what we use to share information. So, again, we're seeing some blurred lines here. I mean, you know, YouTube and Facebook, they're not journalistic institutions, but increasingly they're used as some kind of news platforms. And so we've seen from numerous polls and studies that a majority of Americans believe that, quote, fake news is a problem. Propaganda, misinformation, and disinformation is a problem. Of course, it's long been a problem. It's not just the rise of the Trump era that's ushered it in, as we've long argued. But one of the things, again, that seems to be absent, right, is we see people saying, well, we need fact checkers or we need algorithmic fixes. And again, what we've argued at the project, and I know what you have argued and what you've studied and what you put into your dissertation, is we really need a comprehensive program for critical media literacy education going all the way through the early grades, like is happening in numerous other countries.
That's the long-term strategy, is to get the public basically just better positioned to operate in a democratic government. So start from a young age, teach them about how government works, how to critically think, the influences of media, the influence it can have in their lives, how to protect themselves, all those kinds of things. In the short term, there's a lot of things people can do. I mean, there are a lot of good websites and resources that are out there. Fair and Accuracy and Reporting and Media Matters, like Project Censor, do some good stuff in holding media accountable. You've got fact-checking websites like PolitiFact and Snopes, which can be helpful as well. So it's really getting yourself and the resources, but also changing your behavior as well. I encourage people not to share something only because they read the headline. Like, don't share anything unless you read the entire article. I also encourage people to spend more time reading less. Andy Lee Roth has championed this for quite some time, right? Avoid news inflation. Try and read, give a deeper read to less articles rather than sharing more headlines. Those are some steps you can take in the short term, as we kind of start this transformation of American education and larger culture.
Nolan Higdon, given that we both teach critical thinking and critical media literacy, and also from a more historiographic perspective, what we've also discovered over the years is that we have a tendency to see in our society a way of outsourcing solutions to these problems. And rather than that, if we take it upon ourselves not only to rely on educational institutions to do it, but if we have the drive in ourselves as individuals to want to make sure we're not spreading false information or fake information. There's a recent article in Time Magazine, of all places, a longtime friend of the project, Ken Jenkins, shared this with us, how your brain tricks you into believing fake news. And in it, they interestingly talk about so many of the things that we talk about and that we tell people. And they actually even liken to sort of the spreading of this information, you know, the sort of like, click, share, but there's no actual reading or critical thinking going on. It actually makes it analogous to littering, spreading garbage around.
I think that's a fair analogy. We often use this term, you know, critical thinking, and I think people largely use it but don't define it. You know, they think it's just sort of always being a cynic or taking a critical perspective in the sense that you're always like challenging or being annoying or something like that. But, you know, critical thinking really is asking you to ask where the evidence is and make judgments based off the evidence. And if there's not evidence there, that should be a reason for alarm. So I think it's a skill, you know, that everyone can benefit from and in every field, every walk of life. Especially if you're sifting through all these different headlines and messages, you have to have some sort of measurement system to determine what is true and what is false. And I always tell people about this as well, is credibility. I'm always amazed at how many people continue to appear in news media who've lost their credibility like decades or eons ago, like Donald Trump, for example. why people still cover his messages in news media is beyond me. He's lost credibility. But not only credibility of these media figures, also credibility of like the self. You know, you have, theoretically have to wake up every day and look at yourself in the mirror. Don't you want to know the things you say, the things you believe, the way you act are based to the best of your ability on facts? I mean, I think that's a really sort of powerful thing to think about every day.
So, Nolan, you recently just said the word cynic. I'm wondering, because I just had a debate with some friends about this the other day, can you please dive into the difference between the term skeptic versus cynic?
I think cynics tend to look for the negative on anything or every issue, where I think a skeptic tends to just ask more questions and be not willing to believe right away, but have a lot of questions up front, where I think a cynic generally chooses not to believe. I think there's a small distinction there.
So there's an openness to being skeptical and a closed offness to being a cynic.
Those are definitely good points in terms of differentiation, right? And we've heard the term healthy skepticism, and critical media literacy education, I think, not only teaches a healthy sense of skepticism, but it also provides the kind of tools we need to ask the right questions so we can be in the driver's seat of our own minds in determining what is going on empirically in the world around us. Nolan Higdon, your work can be found, of course, at projectcensored.org. I'd like to thank you for joining us on the other side of the microphone today. Listeners, of course, know Nolan Higdon as being a co-host here, and he will be rejoining us again. Dr. Nolan Higdon, thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Dr. Nolan Higdon wrapping up today's program on the importance of alternative independent media in the face of growing concerns of big tech companies censoring these very voices.
Land supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. It's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips. Mickey Huff is executive producer and host of the program, with co-host and myself, Chase Palmieri. Anthony Fest is our senior producer. Our associate producers are Dennis Murphy and Mitch Scorza. The Project Censored Show airs on over 40 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. To learn more about our work or to find any of our previous programs, please go to www.projectcensored.org. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at Project Censored. Please feel free to share your feedback about our work. Last but not least, thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
About criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguised under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxes, while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons build the capacity, citizens. In the times where the master thief can buy and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love up with our brothers and our